From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the Arab language press in America. Our guest, Edmund Gharib, an internationally recognized scholar of Middle East history and politics. According to the Arab American and Business Association website, Edmund Gharib has served as a professor at many colleges, including American University, Georgetown University, and the University of Virginia. He holds a master's and PhD from Georgetown University. At American University, Professor Gharib was the first Mustafa Barzani Distinguished Scholar for Global Kurdish Studies. Professor Gharib is also an author, co-author, and editor of several widely acclaimed books, including The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, and War in the Gulf. He is also well known for his pioneering work on the U.S. media coverage of the Arab world entitled Split Vision, The Portrayal of Arabs in the American Media. He has written and lectured widely on the Kurds, the Gulf region, U.S.-Arab relations, the Arab Spring, and ethnic and religious identities in the Middle East. In addition to his work in academia, Dr. Gharib is an analyst and frequent commentator for major media outlets in the U.S., the Arab world, and Europe, including AP, CNN, Al Jazeera, Al Hura, and of course, on The Voice of America, where he is interviewed frequently by our Kurdish service. He has also appeared previously on Press Conference USA and on our sister program, Encounter. So we are delighted to welcome him today to talk about his forthcoming book on the Arab language press in America and what it says about the many significant contributions of Arabs to the United States. Edmund Gharib joins us via Skype. Edmund, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I've always enjoyed appearing on your program.
Well, it's mutual. And I want to say in full disclosure, Edmund and I met back in 1997 in Asila, Morocco at a conference on Arab stereotypes in America. And we have remained in contact and have been friends ever since. Edmund, I'd like you to tell us about the history and geography of Arab immigration to the United States. Where did they come from? When and why?
This is a very interesting, fascinating subject because there are a lot of stories about that. When did people from the Middle East region reach the United States? There are some who believe that actually the Phoenicians were the first people who made it to the Americas, North and South America, although this is something that's still being discussed. But what we know for sure is that there were people of Arab origin or Arabs who came with Columbus to the Americas. More recently, there were also papers written in Arabic by an African slave who was brought to the United States, and he wrote about his experiences. Also, that's in the 18th century, and the Library of Congress has acquired these papers, and there was an exhibit of them, and there were a number of articles. But in terms of the modern immigration, we know that there was a Lebanese priest who came to the United States in 1848 to basically try to collect some help aid for his monastery, which was damaged, and he needed help to rebuild it, and he was sent by the church. And then the first Lebanese who came and stayed was Anthony Bishalani. He spoke fluent English. He was converted to Protestantism, but he only lived in the U.S. for about 4 years. He was sick and he died and was buried in New York. And there is a statue for him there. The other interesting story, that's when the real immigration began and we began to see larger numbers of people coming. And they came mostly at the beginning from Lebanon and Syria. And of course, there were missionaries, American missionaries who had gone to the Middle East. And they, as well as other missionaries who went before them, who came from Europe, for example, France, Germany, Italy, these people were interested in, some of them, in converting Muslims, but that wasn't very successful. They ended up converting some of the Eastern Christians to Western forms of Christianity, but they did some important work in terms of starting schools and colleges in different areas of the Middle East. One of them were the American missionaries who started going to the region in Lebanon in 1820. In the early 30s, they established the Syrian Protestant College, which later became the American University of Beirut, one of the best-known universities in the region. And also they started in the 1830s, also a school for girls. Several of them, they started having as well clinics and hospitals to help take care of the health of the people in the area. And so these were the first contacts. That's when people began to know a little bit about America and Americans. Then during the Civil War, President Lincoln issued the Homestead Act, where he gave free land to farmers, to peasants. It took about 8 to 10 years to reach the Middle East. And the story there ended up being that the King of America was giving free land to peasants. And so farmers, peasants, and some of the small villages began to travel to the United States. And also some of them went to South America as well as to the United States and other parts of North America. And that was the real immigration. The first family to come together was the Arbeely family. And it was the family of a Syrian doctor who studied at AUB, at the Syrian Protestant College at that time. And later he taught there. And he and his whole family and two of his sons established the first Arabic language newspaper in the United States. His name was Dr. Joseph Arbeely. And there's another interesting story about one of his sons who was appointed by the American president to become a consul in Jerusalem, Jerusalem consulate. And he spoke not only fluent Arabic and English, but he spoke as well Aramaic, Hebrew, he knew Greek. He knew some Latin as well, and he helped his brothers later. He was a lawyer who started the paper. The paper was established in 1892. They imported a printing press from the Ottoman Empire. At that time, that was very difficult finding a printing press here. It was an old one, but still it took them quite a while to get it here because you know how the situation was in the Ottoman Empire. There was a lot of concern. They were worried about dissident voices, and so that wasn't something easy to get printing presses. Nevertheless, they succeeded, and they began to publish a weekly newspaper called The Star of America, Kaukab America, and that survived for several years. They published also the first Arabic language book in the United States, which was a book on how to teach new immigrants the English language. It was published in Arabic and English, and it was apparently quite useful. They reissued it. That also at the time, this was the beginning of large numbers of people who began to come to the United States. As I said earlier, most of them were from Lebanon and Syria. There were some Palestinians also who started to come to the United States. Some of them came to the fair, the Philadelphia and the Chicago fair, brought with them olive wood, as well as some crafts and some silk to sell. And some of them stayed, some went back. But by the end of the century, around 1900, there may have been somewhere around 40 to 50,000 people from that part of the world. And the number increased by the 20s until there were probably somewhere close to 350,000, 400,000 people.
Well, let me interrupt you. The professor you are, you've given us a terrific lecture, a very interesting history, Edmund. But I'm going to take a short break and then we'll be back and ask you some more specific questions about this incredible immigration. So you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Edmund Gharib. He's a Middle East scholar and author of a forthcoming book on the Arab language press in America. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower from Turkey, M. Yavuz Sokakli. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And it was no coincidence that I mentioned a listener from Turkey, Edmund, because I do want to talk about the biggest, from what I understand, immigration more recent came from the Ottoman Empire. The fall of the Ottoman Empire, if I'm not mistaken, precipitated quite an exodus from Arab lands coming to the United States. And I wanted you to tell us specifically where they settled. You know, specifically, was it the Midwest? I know in my own state of Pennsylvania, we had a relatively vibrant Middle Eastern community, mostly from Syria and Lebanon, mostly Christians. But I just discovered recently a small Syrian Alawite community who had built a mosque and community center, which I only discovered this year. So tell us more specifically, you know, where they settled, what types of vocations, professions did they enter? You know, you can then talk about how they started this vibrant Arab language press.
This is a very, very good point, because when these people first started coming, as I said, these were the countries. There were a few people like from Iraq, a handful, a few also from Egypt, but mostly it was Lebanon and Syria. And what's even more interesting, most of these people were Christians. There were also some other minorities. There were some Jews who came from that area as well. There were, as you pointed out, in your hometown in Pennsylvania, Alawite community. And this is a topic that's not very well known. Actually, I'm grateful to you. You're the one who told me about this community in Pennsylvania. And in fact, I was speaking with some Alawi friends in the United States recently and asked them if they knew about this community. Actually, they didn't even know. I was fortunate to speak with one of them. He told me how his family came. He believes that his father came around either 1898 or 1900, and they settled in Pennsylvania, and they had a thriving community, and they had good relationship with the other members of the, they were described at that time, Syrian community, although in the beginning, there was one time where they were described by the immigration as Turks. And this later would create a problem around 1907. The U.S. government banned the coming of people from that region for a short while because they considered them Turks of the yellow race, basically, and Mongol. One of the things, despite the differences and disagreements sometimes within the community based on regional issues or political or sectarian factors, nevertheless, they all united and they sued and they went to the court and they were able to reverse that. And they were considered Caucasians at that time. Then came the war, the First World War, and that stopped some of the immigrants from coming because of the blockade and because the Ottoman government took over the area and there was actually famine. Tens of thousands of people died from starvation at that time. And the community in the United States, which had been, as I said, probably at that time, maybe around 300,000 or thereabout, they had collected some money to provide assistance to the starving people in Lebanon at that time. And some of the people who were involved in this were actually the Arabic language papers, which we'll talk a little bit more about, as well as some of the prominent writers who emerged also within the bosom of this newspaper movement, the newspapers that were published in the U.S. and later became very well known, not only within the Arabic-speaking community or in the Arab world, but some even in the United States, people like Gibran, Khalil Gibran, the author of The Prophet, which is probably one of the best-selling books. At one time, he was the third poet after Shakespeare in terms of circulation of his books. After Shakespeare and Lao Tzu, millions of copies of his books have been printed and sold. There's Amin Rihani, the historian, political activist, the father of modern free verse, of the Arabic free verse movement, which now has spread throughout the Middle East and the Arabic-speaking world. And there's also Mikhail Naimi, the critic who published articles as well in the New York Times, in the prominent American newspapers. He was someone who was fluent in Arabic, Russian, English, and French, and published in numerous publications. And he was a literary critic. He was a short story writer and a philosopher. There were a number of these people who emerged. But this is where the press, and probably this is what we want to talk about, the role of this press and how did this press came about and how widespread it was, because this was truly a phenomenon for a small community to publish such a large number of newspapers in the United States. In fact, there are still some magazines and papers published in Arabic today, but the heydays of that press really were from the 1890s until, I would say, the 40s, where you had a very vibrant Arabic language press. And they also started publishing in English as well.
And Edmund, we know that Michigan attracted many of the immigrants from Arab lands after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. You know, Dearborn is known as sort of like the capital of Arab America. Why did they go there? What attracted them
Actually, you know, that this is a very good point. By the way, it's not just Detroit, although Detroit probably today has the largest Arab American community of any city in the U.S., but in fact, New York. Some came, of course, through New Orleans. They came from California through Mexico. Some went to Latin America and then came to North America. Others went the other way, but it was New York, the main port where the majority came. And many settled in New York. Some settled in New England, places like Northampton. That's where my family members, some of my family members went. Northampton, Springfield, Worcester, Boston, to New Hampshire also, Maine. And then, of course, to Pennsylvania. That's where actually, I would say, the third or fourth Arabic language newspapers were born in the city of Philadelphia. Then, of course, in Ohio, Michigan became an attraction because of the auto industry there. That's where many of them went and started working. And by the way, there's another community, Arab American community, that did not come from Syria and Lebanon, Palestine, and later Iraq and Egypt. This was a Yemeni community. There's a small community in New York. There's a large community in Detroit and also in California. Some went to Iowa, some went to Minnesota, and of course to the south, some went to Arizona and Texas. As time went by, more and more people. In addition, for example, in Chicago, you have one of the largest Assyrian communities, as well as there are large Assyrian communities in North and South California. And you have even a television station, Assyrian television station there. The Chaldean Catholic Christians, Iraqis, who started coming also around 1920s, larger numbers, which is the largest community of Iraqi background. They are settled, most of them, in Detroit, and there's a huge community of them there. More recently, it was Lebanese again, the second wave who came because as a result of the civil war in Lebanon in 1975. And there were many Christians of various sects, Maronite, Greek Orthodox, Greek Catholics, as well as Shiite communities. And of course, since the war in Iraq, Detroit has also attracted Iraqi Muslims, particularly Shiites, who are there now, and there's a thriving community. So you have a large Shiite Lebanese community, as well as Shiite Iraqi community in Detroit, Dearborn, and other areas, but this is where the largest concentration went. And there were different waves. They came at different times. Some of them sold Middle Eastern artifacts and icons and peddlers and went from town to town, from house to sell. Generally, many of them didn't like working in factories. And very quickly, many of them started having their own businesses. In fact, the first bank that was established in New York by the Faour brothers, four brothers, well-educated, was in 1891. There were also some business people who started establishing stores, businesses that began to bring food from the Middle East and started some Middle East restaurants. So they tended to move more and more in the direction of doing business. And later, they educated their children, established their own societies, organizations, and these societies, by the way, some of them were based on the sect. There were Catholic societies, Maronite societies, Orthodox societies, but there were also nationalist societies. There were, for example, also something that's not well known. There was also a Syrian Jewish organization, which was established in New York in the 20s and 30s. And they considered themselves as part of, at that time, what was described as a Syrian community, which referred to all the people who came from the Levant area. So there was this thriving community. What was interesting about them is even though some of them barely could read and write, some of them were well educated, they emphasized education for their children. And many of their children actually did not only go to business, but they went into the professions. Found a lot of lawyers, doctors, engineers. For example, Dr. Michael DeBakey, the famous heart surgeon. Even before him, there was a younger doctor who ended up going with two of his Jewish colleagues to help the Chinese in the 1930s fight against diseases that were widespread and poverty in China. So you had a very diverse and very vibrant and hardworking community. And today you find many of them who have also even begun to enter into politics as well, although generally in the past, not many of them entered into politics. But in politics, we saw, for example, some senators, such as Senator James Abarez or James Abner, also a senator from Michigan, some members of Congress. But generally, most of them moved in the direction of the professions as well as business.
Very, very fascinating. And of course, Edmund, you and I have always talked about the fact that there's so much more convergence among various religious groups, whether Jews, Muslims, and Christians in the Arab world, than differences. And you just underscored that. But let's get to the press in the few minutes we have left. What does the Arab language press tell us about the community? What prompted you to home in on this area? And what struck you by the variety and content of the publications? If you could give us some prominent examples.
Actually, what's so interesting about this is that you had this small community that published between 1892 and around 1930, somewhere close to 80 newspapers and magazines. I've discovered also one newspaper in Upper State New York, which nobody has ever even mentioned. These papers were very important. In fact, almost before even they started, they built mosques or churches or synagogues. Some of them at the same time started newspapers. Basically, there was the beginning of a renaissance, intellectual renaissance in Lebanon and Syria, particularly Lebanon, because of schools, because of the role of missionaries, education. And people began to rediscover ancient Arab history, Islamic history. In the beginning, they focused on religious texts, but later began to focus on history, on literature, etc. And then when they came to the United States, the free environment, they were very much influenced and affected by what they saw as the freedom of the press, the freedom of expression. And that was something very important. They wanted to liberate their countries, which they saw as being controlled by the Ottoman Empire, especially as the Ottoman Empire began to decline the last couple of centuries before its collapse, was quite repressive. There was a lot of corruption, and there was also some religious discrimination. And so as a result of this, they decided to emphasize this and to help liberate their people. But the more important thing is that they wanted the paper serve as a school, as an education, to educate the immigrants who came, that taught them about American laws, American customs, articles. El Buda newspaper had a weekly column called Your Doctor, where people would write letters asking about certain diseases, how to deal with some of their own problems, would describe their symptoms, etc. And they would get answers from some of the doctors. They would also learn about how the immigrants could become U.S. citizens. Also kept the communities in touch with each other. And what's even more interesting is that these newspapers, such as one of the most influential, and until its demise in 1993, called Al Huda, was published in New York, that was one of the newspapers, the second oldest Arabic language newspaper in the world, next to Al Ahram in Egypt, until it died. That was the second oldest paper. And it played a very major role. It had correspondents. They began to learn from American press, the American newspapers, to separate opinion from news, how they began to even summarize the articles. Also, they played a major role, not only in connecting the communities here, but they had, for example, correspondents in South America, in Cuba, some of them in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, in Australia, in Istanbul, in Cairo, in Damascus, in Beirut. And that was very, very interesting. But some of them, of course, focused in certain areas because some of them were somewhat aligned with their either regional issues. There were disagreements, for example, between the Lebanese nationalists who wanted Lebanon to become an independent country and the Arabists or the Syrian nationalists also who wanted it to have one country for that whole region. And so there were political disagreements, and sometimes certain newspapers reflected the views of a certain religious community. But there were those who were above that also and who played an important role to try to eradicate these divisions. For example, there was a very important woman by the name of Afifa Karam, who was considered as one of 600 American women journalists in the early part of the 1900s. She focused on women's rights, on the need to educate women, on the rights of women to be educated, to choose their own husband. And she also was someone when people would sometimes ask, who is this woman? In the paper she wrote for Al Huda and others, she also wrote novels and translated novels from English and French. She said, I am Muslim. I am a Christian, although her religion was Christian. She said, I am a Christian. I am a Jew. I am an Osiris. Qadiri, which are the Alawis, another term for Alawis. I am a Buddhist. My faith is between me and my God. I am all of these, and I believe that God sent these religious guides and prophets to teach all humanity. She said how much the American experience also was very important to her, and especially the freedom that the United States provided. And that was extremely important, especially freedom of expression, and also how she learned about the rights that American women were gaining much more so than where she came from. And so the other important thing is she started a magazine focusing on women called The New World's Woman, basically New World, the term in Arabic for America. And this magazine was one of only three magazines focusing on women's issues throughout the whole Arabic-speaking world. So here in America, you had one of these magazines which survived for about 2 years, and then with the war, and she had some financial difficulties, and she died very young. She was 41 years old when she passed away.
What year did she pass away?
1924.
So after World War I. Well, Edmund, it's been fascinating to learn about how these Arab Americans were so influenced by the American press, freedom of the press. Conversely, did their publications have any impact on their homelands? I mean, did people back home read and learn and also benefit from?
Oh, very much so. This is a great question, Carol. At least two that I know of, there may have been more. Two of the editors of the papers were sentenced to death because they called for liberating their people, for more rights for the people. Some favored a consociational state between the Arabs and the Turks under the Ottoman Empire, but some wanted independence. So two of these people, their homes were taken over by the government and they were sentenced to death. Some were loyal to the Ottoman government, but generally they were people who wanted to have freedom. The other interesting thing about them is that they launched a literary movement. It was in these papers that people like Gibran began to write. I mean, Rihani, the very well-known traveler, philosopher, politician, he is the one who traveled throughout the Arab world, went to the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula when nobody was going. Iraq wrote several books about them. He was also, as I said, the father of the free verse movement. And there's Naimi, there's Aliya Abu Mahdi, the famous poet. There was an American journalist by the name of Habib Katib. He became a correspondent for the Brooklyn Eagle, the Boston Globe, and the Detroit Free Press for a couple of years in the 1920s, early 30s in the Middle East. He was a correspondent. He was the author of a number of books. There were Philip Hetty, one of the first to introduce Arabic language studies at Princeton in the United States. You had people like Majid Kadouri, who was the first to introduce courses on Islamic law in the United States. And then he founded the Middle East section of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Many prominent academics also played a role. And this movement of these writers were read and greatly admired and launched a revolution in terms of the writing. First of all, it opened their minds to the ideas that came from the United States and not only from Europe. They had begun to learn something about European writers and philosophers. But now you had also American poets, American writers, American political leaders were getting to be known. And they launched this new movement that we are still feeling it. And the movement, by the way, their influence was not only on the literature and in terms of the political ideas, but also on trying to create technology, medicine, etc. For example, one of the technological innovations was the brother of the editor of Al-Huda, which is, as we mentioned, the longest surviving paper. He adapted the linotype machine that was invented in the United States to Arabic, and it made it much easier, much faster to print newspapers. And these machines were sold not only to Arabic language newspapers in the United States, but Arabic language newspapers in the Arab world began to import these. So technologically also, there was this innovation. And then publishing books. They published books on history, and American Constitution was translated to Arabic, the writings of the founding fathers. I recently saw a book that was published on the writings of Benjamin Franklin. There were many other teaching about American history, about the French Revolution. This was a very vibrant movement, which influenced not only the community here, but also the countries where they came.
Indeed. Well, you're certainly describing a very important legacy. Edmund Gharib is a widely respected scholar and professor of Middle East history and politics And his forthcoming book recounts a history of the Arab language press in America. Edmund, for now, we want to thank you for your fascinating insights on this topic. Another example of how an immigrant community has greatly enriched and been enriched by American society and culture. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Thank you.